beschäftigt. Und da gibt es eine laufende Petition beim Bundestag, habe ich jetzt aber auch die E-Mail-Adresse nicht auswendig, könnte ich auch noch nachliefern, sodass Ihre Hörer das vielleicht bei Ihnen beim Sender anfordern könnten. Oder eben auch bei uns, also über unsere Homepage, keine A49, verkehrswendejetzt.de, könnte man auch diese Daten alle noch anfordern, wenn man diese Petition unterstützen möchte.
Gut, da danke ich Ihnen recht herzlich. Ich sprach mit Barbara Schlemmer von der Bürgerinitiative Keiner A49 über die Polizeigewalt von Räumungen von Aktivistinnen aus Triports und Baumhäusern, wie es aufgearbeitet wird. Die Linke im Bundestag will einen parlamentarischen Untersuchungsausschuss einrichten. Mal sehen, wie es da weitergeht. Und über das wasserrechtliche Gutachten und überhaupt, wie es weitergeht bei dem Widerstand gegen die A49. In my dream, the world was silver underneath a magic moon. In my dream, I lay there waiting, you came naked to my room. In my dream, I lay there waiting, you came naked to my room. Woke up sweating, arms on empty, 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Every day the world goes faster, turning faster than it seems. Let's not talk about tomorrow. Leave me here on the street of dreams. Leave me here on the street of dreams. Street of dreams. Walk right by me and the gutter, lying here outside your door. I look up and see you burning up on the ones and more. Look as far away as moonshine, every deal is shaky hand. Fame is just an empty bottle, fortune's just a one night stand. Every day the world goes faster, turning faster than it seems. Let's not talk about tomorrow. Every day the world goes faster, turning faster than it seems. Well, let's not talk about tomorrow.
Welcome to another edition of The Week Ahead in Russia, RFERL's regular podcast about significant developments in upcoming events in Moscow and beyond. I'm Mike Eckel, senior correspondent here in Prague, filling in for our regular host, Steve Gutterman. 1993, February, St. Petersburg. Russian authorities announced the seizure of over a metric ton, more than $100 million, of cocaine. The cocaine was stashed in cans of corned beef that was shipped from Colombia and smuggled into Russia by road via Finland. The man whose agents seized the drugs was Viktor Cherkesov, known during Soviet times as a merciless KGB investigator. He was also a confidant of another KGB alumnus, who at the time was St. Petersburg's deputy mayor and the man overseeing the city's foreign affairs. That's Vladimir Putin. Cherkesov, who headed the Russian drug agency, promised high-profile criminal trials into the coke bust. Nothing ever happened. Cherkesov's office halted the investigation 7 months later, saying merely that the main suspects had fled the country. The cocaine itself disappeared from view. A new investigation by RFERL has uncovered multiple links between individuals implicated in the drug smuggling and the St. Petersburg mayor's office, where Putin worked. The findings echo past allegations that Putin himself was involved in the drug smuggling. It's all a very interesting asterisk in the political trajectory of Putin. And join me now to discuss the RFERL investigation are two of its authors. That would be Andrei Soshnikov, an investigative correspondent with Current Time, and Carl Schreck, RFERL's enterprise editor. Здорово, мужики. Добро пожаловать.
Здравствуй, Mike. Hello, Mike.
Hello, everyone.
Great. So thanks for joining me, guys. And again, the new investigation, which you can find in Russian and in English on our websites, is in fact the first in a series of upcoming articles looking into the backstory of Putin's rise to power. If you want to understand what Putinism is, and you want to understand why what Russia is today, why Russia is what it is today, the oligarchs, the Siloviki, capital flight, offshore banks, sanctions, all of it, you have to first take a look at St. Petersburg, Putin's hometown, and where he first made the transition into politics. Andrei, tell us, what is the main takeaway of this first chapter of the investigation?
Thank you. I'll say it again. It was February 1993, quite a depressing time for Russia, to say at least. A ton of cocaine had been intercepted at the Russo-Finnish border. Cargo from Colombia that was delivered by the ship and passed the Finnish customs unnoticed as quote-unquote cans of Colombian stew. And according to the head of the local KGB branch, who was Putin's one of the closest ally, Viktor Cherkesov, Russian customs officers noticed that some cans did not have markings, and upon opening them they found the cocaine inside, and the route had been tracked by authorities in multiple countries, including Israel. And Israel is the only country that convicted some of the people who were behind this operation. They were citizens of Israel, and we've interviewed two people directly linked to this Israel investigation. This was the first interview of the actual person who was convicted for his role in this operation, and the first interview of a witness of this operation that was questioned by Israel investigators. We've also found some Israeli investigative records, Russian police documents that were never observed before, and also you can check in our story on our landing page a very unique video and newspaper archives that were never published before. So the Israeli convict says that the paperwork he carried for the cocaine consignment listed a recipient as the St. Petersburg government's public health watchdog, which was under control of the mayor's office. And Putin knew that cocaine will be delivered to St. Petersburg, and he knew that there was a big-scale operation by Interpol to deliver it to Europe and to catch criminals in Europe. But something happened, and Russian police decided to act and captured the cargo itself. our witness told us that the Israeli businessmen who were one of the main guys in this operation had met with, first of all, Putin's boss, Anatoly Sobchak, and another criminal had met with some mysterious person who was intermediate between Sobchak and criminals and worked for the mayor's office. And he used pseudonym and we didn't find this person, but anyway, it was noticing. And the only person who was arrested by the Russian police in Russia with connection to this case and spent half a year in prison but wasn't convicted is nowadays a famous football agent who worked with several football, or you can say soccer, stars. He's not a criminal anymore, but nobody knew these details about his past. So these are our main points, our main takeaway of this investigation.
Wow, that's pretty incredible. I encourage everyone, if you haven't already, to check out the investigations published in English and in Russian on our websites. And a correction, I guess, in my introduction, I said Cherkasov was the head of the Russian Drug Control Agency. At the time, he later became the head of the Russian Drug Control Agency. But he was still all along a confidant of the deputy mayor of St. Petersburg, Vladimir Putin. So, Carl, let's step back and look at the larger significance for a moment of Putin's time in St. Petersburg. Can we draw a direct line from his time as deputy mayor in Petersburg, where this case was one of several scandals, to Russia's political situation today?
Thanks, Mike. Well, I would say one thing you really have to look at, and Andrei is a native of St. Petersburg, so he probably knows this better than I, but I think the complete dominance of organized crime, particularly in St. Petersburg at the time when Putin launched his basically entered into politics, in the mayor's office. I think that was really formative for how he understood, the relationship between between the state and the electorate. I think it really we see echoes of that in the way Russia's run under under Putin now, and I'm thinking specifically of cronyism, patronage, the use of law enforcement authorities for the enrichment of insiders. I mean, if we just look at the people who have become incredibly wealthy. I mean, just the number of Putin friends and insiders who've become enormously wealthy, due in large part to connections to the state cash cow, is really remarkable. And so I think while it was a much smaller scale in St. Petersburg, you see a lot of the same motifs in Russia today and under Putin's reign. In this particular case, in the cocaine case, what's quite interesting as well is I think this still this idea that the state doesn't owe any sort of accountability to the electorate. I mean, when Putin's confidant Viktor Cherkasov, when his team seized this metric ton of cocaine, in the beginning there was a big press conference and promises there'd be a trial. They said they would use the cocaine for medical purposes. It would be repurposed for medical use. And there were regular reports in the police in the papers about the course of the investigation. And then after that, after these promises that this metric ton of cocaine would be repurposed for medical use, it just completely dropped off the radar. And this was, for me, probably the biggest red flag in the whole story. There was never any, we could never find a single press release or press conference saying, hey, look, we've used all this cocaine. repurpose it for medical use and make all this money for the state. I mean, technically, that metric ton of cocaine was in the hands of the Russian taxpayer. And what happened to it, we have absolutely no idea.
Yeah. So one chapter.
Free, free Palestine!
Free, free Palestine!
Free, free Palestine!
Free, free Palestine!
From the river to the sea!
From the river to the sea!
And Dutch complicity!
And Dutch complicity!
Free, free Palestine!
Free Palestine!
After Putin's time in St. Petersburg that has been under scrutiny, examined closely in the past, and keeps coming up as a recurring theme, is the question of food supplies. Because back after the Soviet collapse, St. Petersburg faced food shortages, and City Hall made various arrangements to try and fill the gap and, you know, keep its residents from starving. And those arrangements included barter deals where these fly-by-night firms, these fly-by-night companies, pocketed millions of dollars, despite the fact that no food shipments were, in fact, delivered in exchange. Andre, as Carl said, you're a native of St. Petersburg. Talk to us a little bit about the whole food barter arrangement that was also noteworthy during Putin's time in St. Petersburg politics.
I agree. First of all, I agree with Carl that the main term that you can associate with Putin's regime is impunity. He learned how to do business and how to govern in the 1990s, and he was never seriously questioned or convicted for any of the dark stories that he was involved with. And one of the stories was investigated by a Russian politician, Marina Saliyeva, in 1992. I remember this time that you could get food or basic products, but you had to pay for them with international currencies. If you needed a cheap food, you had to stay in lines for a very long time, and there was a danger of like a serious problems for the city because of the food shortages. So the mayor's office decided to exchange some earth metals, oil products, and other raw materials for over $100 million. And used barter contracts. In return, the city had to receive some food, but the foodstuffs never materialized. And Marina Saliyeva, who was a member of the local parliament, investigated these activities and had access to some documents that had even Putin's signature on them. And it's very easy to check that the city was promised to receive food from some companies and never received any of these very important products that people really needed at that time. And Putin was the person to pick these companies. There was no like a public procurement system with competition and due diligence. He just picked some suspicious companies. Some of them belonged to the friends of the mayor. Some of them belonged to the people close to criminal. Some of them belonged to we don't know who. And city lost these very important oil products and earth materials that could be exported for a price of $100 million, never received any food. Mm-hmm. It happened 30 years ago, and still we can see the same pattern every time with any corruption scandal Putin or his associates were involved in. The same impunity repeats itself all the time.
Carl mentioned that there's a really great video that we published as part of this investigation. You can find it on our website that involves some really fascinating archival footage of the cocaine bust and really does a lot to illuminate this story. And as I mentioned earlier, this first chapter, this first investigation is part of an upcoming series of RFERL stories regarding corruption scandals and scams that swirled around Putin and his associates as he began his political ascent. Carl, talk to us what's coming down the road next.
Yeah, we've got some really interesting stories coming down the pipeline here. They will, they're mostly connected to Putin's External Relations Committee, influential committee that Putin headed at the mayor's office. You know, these are corruption stories that are very illustrative of how business was done with his committee during that time. And so I would, for anyone interested in these stories, please keep an eye on our website throughout the week and our Twitter feed, our social media feeds, because we've uncovered details and stories that have seemingly long since been forgotten or never got the scrutiny they deserved in the first place.
And again, as you know, both Andrei and Carl have referred to, you can easily draw a direct line from the early days of Putin's political career in St. Petersburg to the state of leadership and the management style that we have seen, that we're seeing today in today's Russia. And I think there's a lot to be learned in looking at those historical parallels. So I look forward to the next chapter of our investigation. So we have a little bit of time remaining, so let's take a few questions from our listeners. Again, you can raise your hand in the by hitting the button in Twitter Spaces. You can also send us a direct message, or you can post your question as a reply to the tweet pinned in this Twitter space. We'll try to get through as many questions as we can. Let's see what we get for a question, if any. And there may not be any. Again, if you do have a question, you can raise your hand by hitting the button in the Twitter Spaces. You can also send us a direct message or simply post your question as a reply to the tweet pinned in this Twitter space. While we're waiting for a question to come in, I'll throw a question at Carl. Where's Cherkisov now? He's not somebody you hear about a lot these days. Do we know what happened to him?
Yeah, so he has kind of fallen off the fallen off the map a bit in recent years. So as we said, he served in the KGB together with Putin, was the top FSB official in St. Petersburg for a long time. Then when Putin moved to the Kremlin, he Cherkisov got increasingly appointed to increasingly more powerful posts, including as Russia's top narcotics official in 2003. There's an interesting backstory because I think it was 2007 or 2008, there was some really nasty infighting between security agencies, and Cherkisov ended up publishing a letter saying that the security services must not fall victim victim to this infighting, and it was seen as a really rare example of a security services insider going public with airing basically their dirty laundry publicly. Mm-hmm. He went on to serve in the Duma in the Russian Parliament for a few years, but he since 2016 he's been out of Parliament, and there's. Yeah, I don't really have any credible information as to where he is right now or exactly what he's doing.
Interesting. We have one person who has a question, their hand raised. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Clinton DeVoe here, contributor with the Ottawa Hill Times, as well as City News Radio Network in Canada and Troy Media. So based off of the history of Vladimir Putin sort of leaving government military agencies or security agencies and then becoming, I don't want to say elected, but like it becoming a part of the so-called representative government. Do we have any sort of idea who may be a likely successor to Putin, based off of some of your understanding of these people that he worked with, at the city level as he eventually became the person that we all know and recognize today? And if we don't have any sort of idea, is that a failure on our part in the West when it comes to our intelligence gathering? Because it seems like the more I hear about what's been happening over the last 3 or 4 months, that there's this fear that a vacuum will be created if and when Putin is removed from office. So I'm just curious your thoughts on that.
Andre, you want to handle that one? A question of a successor to Putin, and if and when he relinquishes power.
Well, the successor of the Putin is the question of not the near future, I guess. I'm not a political scientist, but I don't see any evidence that he's willing to give any power. And he can leave the presidential office or Kremlin, but he can still be a very influential person, like it happened in Kazakhstan. And speaking about the decision, former Russian President Yeltsin's decision to put Putin on the power, knowing that he had some dirty business in his past. Well, I saw how Westerners were very happy with this decision, since he's not a communist and he was not a nationalist, and he never expressed any of these views. And that was enough for the West at that time. And we've seen different Putins over these 20 years. And the first few years of Putin in power, he used to be a reformer. And he relied on some people with liberal and democratic views on how to build an economy. But unfortunately, it was a trap. Because while they were building a strong economy in Russia, a very technocratic state, I would say that many services that were built are very useful and people admire it. But all these budget systems and easy taxes and all this infrastructure was used for PR of illiberal views of Russia inside the country and outside the countries, and for the wars, the war in Chechnya, Second Chechen War, the war in Georgia when Russia annexed the South Ossetia, and the war in Ukraine, which we face right now, and we really need to tell about it because it's atrocities happens there. So now we can definitely see it was a mistake, and that the fact that Putin never expressed any of his views that he expresses now was not enough to be so glad that Yeltsin picked someone insane as it was understand it back then.
It's a good reminder how Putin was viewed at the very early days of his presidency. He was indeed embraced as this, you know, stabilizing figure and wholly welcomed in the West, and that was 22 years ago. The next Russian presidential election is 2024. All bets are off if there's going to be a presidential election, and who's going to be the successor? There's no real clear indication at this stage in the game. There is another question that's popped up from a listener named Wendy, I believe. Wendy?
Yes.
Hi, go ahead.
I always wanted to work in the State Department, and when Trump took over and he just completely gutted the State Department, it was like a heart, like a knife in my heart. And then he started making some moves on Radio Free Europe, and that was another thing I thought he was doing for Putin, and I just, And so he hasn't been able to reverse the post office problem yet, and I'm just wondering if Biden's been able to kind of reverse whatever damage happened to Radio Free Europe.
That is a question that I'm going to have to punt. This podcast is about Russia and Putin and this new investigation that we've published here. That's not to say, there's plenty to be said. It's all positive, I would say. But I'm going to put that question to the side and keep the discussion more on topic. I see another hand, though I can't tell who the listener is. One second. It's our listener, Clinton, who I believe asked a question previously. Go ahead, Clinton.
Yeah, hi. Thanks a lot. Clinton DeVoe here again. So follow-up question to my previous one. Is there any sort of understanding at the municipal level in Russia, not necessarily someone who has spoken out against Putin, but is there anyone at the municipal level that appears to have consolidated support from people within their respective cities or towns within Russia that could then use that as a way, as leverage, if you will, to sort of follow the path that Putin did, 30 years ago, that sort of thing?
That's a good question. I have a couple of thoughts that come to mind, but I'm going to kick it to Carl and Andre, see which one of you might have a thought about regional leaders who perhaps have a regional base, an electoral base that could potentially be used to build a larger political movement. Carl Andre, which one of you wants to handle that?
I can go first. I would say that from the beginning of Putin's reign, he's been extremely wary of regional leaders with, let's say, too much sway and power in their own regions. That one of his first tasks was to basically rein in the regions that were kind of off doing their own thing. You've seen appointments of governors in recent years where people who aren't from the region at all are appointed to lead various regions with which they don't really have much connection at all. The short answer is I don't see anyone with a type of profile that you could easily say, yes, this person is prepared to step right in. And part of that is I would say, Putin's own doing, and which is extremely problematic, is he has created a system that essentially only he is capable of managing. And at some point, his rule will end. And what happens after that is a big question. I would say the one exception with this is Chechnya, where Ramzan Kadyrov has basically been handed the region and told to that he can run it however he wishes, even if it's not in compliance with Russian federal laws. But this is just part of a bargain to essentially keep Chechnya quiet, and in exchange for Kadyrov's basic autonomy there.
Of course,
thank
sir.
Thank you for answering my question. I appreciate that.
Of course, there are several examples of actual bodyguards, officers with the Federal Protective Service who have been appointed governors by the Kremlin. And then there's the case of the Khabarovsk governor, Sergei Furgal, who had his wings clipped in a dramatic fashion a couple years back by the Kremlin. Any other questions we can take in the remaining time that we have? It doesn't look like it. So with that, I'm going to call it a day and say thank you both to Andrei and Carl for joining us both. And again, I remind people, please go check out the investigation in Russian and English on our websites, and be on the lookout for the next installment of our investigation into the political corruption scandals and scams that that characterized Putin's early years in St. Petersburg. Again, this conversation will also be published, republished as a podcast. You can find it on our website. You can also subscribe to The Week Ahead in Russia and find many of RFERL's other podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and other similar places. I'm Mike Eckel. Thanks for listening.
Welkom bij de Bits of Freedom podcast. In aflevering 2 van onze Godwin special ter ere van Bevrijdingsdag duiken we opnieuw in de aanslag op het bevolkingsregister van Amsterdam in 1943. We onderzoeken hoe verzet mogelijk is in een tijd van digitalisering en stellen de vraag: zijn we nog steeds even kwetsbaar door de gegevens die over ons worden verzameld door de overheid?
Geen datalekken, achterbakse tracking, geen bizarre wetten, gewoon geen wereldvreemde shit voor het wereldwijde web. Wil jij weten wat er speelt rondom het internet? Dit is Bits of Freedom.
In de eerste aflevering van onze Godwin special bespraken we de lessen die we kunnen leren uit die aanslag op het bevolkingsregister. Zoals de les voor onze overheid dat het opslaan van gegevens met de consequenties komt. We gingen op zoek naar een modern equivalent voor de persoonsbewijzen van toen. En hoewel dat er niet precies is, wezen veel van de experts die we spraken ons op de gegevens zoals opgeslagen liggen in de basisregistratie personen, de BRP. Vandaag zoomen we in op het andere deel, namelijk hoe pleeg je verzet in een digitale wereld? Is het met alle beveiliging en backups überhaupt nog wel mogelijk om bij deze gegevens te komen als het zou betekenen dat je daarmee 70.000 stadsgenoten kunt redden? We gaan erover in gesprek met hacker Frank Platel. Hoi Frank.
Hoi.
En dat doe ik natuurlijk niet alleen, maar met onze directeur en mijn vaste tafelgast Evelyn Austin. Hi Evelyn.
Hi.
Frank, jij bent hacker, onder andere voor je eigen bedrijf laatjehacken.nl. Nu weet ik dat veel mensen als ze aan een hacker denken, toch nog steeds denken aan iemand in een hoodie die ergens in een kelder obscure dingen zit te doen op het internet. Kan je me uitleggen wat je als hacker eigenlijk doet?
Ik zit meestal als hacker met mijn hoodie in de kelder obscure dingen te doen.
Oh jee, de mensen hebben gelijk.
Ja, dat is wel waar. Nou, meestal zit ik op zolder. Nou ja, ik denk dat hackers onderzoekers zijn die gewoon uit willen zoeken hoe iets werkt en dat op een misschien een manier kunnen misbruiken of anders gebruiken dan waar het voor bedoeld is. Zo kwamen er een tijdje geleden, al een hele tijd geleden voordat het internet er was, mensen erachter dat je gratis kon bellen door piepjes in een telefoon af te laten gaan. En nu mogen we als hackers kijken hoe je informatiebeveiliging kan omzeilen.
Ja, precies. En dat is wat jij als hacker ook doet in opdracht van bedrijven, toch? Ja. Kijken hoe hun beveiliging goed genoeg is.
Ja, precies. We mogen gewoon fysiek en digitaal iets ergens inbreken.
Oké. Interessant. Ja, dat is kennis die we wel kunnen gebruiken in deze aflevering, denk ik.
Nou, ik werd wel nieuwsgierig naar dat fysiek.
Ja, fysiek gebeurt ook. Dus dan gaan we met een vermomming naar binnen of met een trucje. Soms als printerleverancier of dan bellen we van tevoren en dan vragen we of we toners komen ophalen. En dan vragen we tussen neus en lippen door, wat voor printer heb je dan? Ja. En dan trekken we een t-shirtje aan met het logo van die printerleverancier en dan gaan we naar binnen.
Wat super vet. Doe jij dat ook zelf of gaat iemand anders undercover?
Nee hoor, dat doe ik ook zelf.
Wat nice. Ja. Daar moet je wel een hele andere skill set voor hebben dan voor het digitale deel, denk ik.
Ja, dat is een beetje anders. Maar wat we uiteindelijk willen doen is een achterdeur ergens inzetten bij een organisatie. Dus dan komt er ook wel een hoop techniek bij kijken en maken we een klein kastje wat we ergens in het netwerk inprikken.
Ja, precies. Dus dan maak je dus een combinatie tussen het fysieke, dus je komt ergens binnen en dan ga je toch nog proberen om ergens iets in te prikken, zodat je kan kijken hoe het digitaal beveiligd
precies,
is.
Precies, dan gaan we digitaal verder. Ja.
Doe je dat ook wel eens als podcastgast ergens? Want dan moeten we straks even de server gaan te checken.
Geen zorgen.
In onze vorige aflevering hebben we het vrij uitgebreid gehad over die basisregistratie personen. Maar ik wil van vooraf al even flaggen. In ons voorgesprek zei je al, ja, de gegevens in die basisregistratie personen, als een land, zoals België, komen we straks op, kwaad in de zin heeft, dan hebben ze die gegevens waarschijnlijk al. Of delen daarvan, flarden daarvan.
Ja, dat denk ik wel. Kijk, in dit geval hebben we het over België. België ligt dicht bij Nederland. Als je daar te hard rijdt, dan kunnen ze ook informatie opvragen over je kenteken. Dus er zijn al wel wat routes voor België. En daarnaast staat er natuurlijk op dit moment veel meer informatie beschikbaar op internet. Dus ze kunnen ook alle informatie die je op Facebook of Instagram hebt gezet, scrapen. Ja. En ze hebben als statelijke actor gewoon wel wat mogelijkheden om informatie op te vragen.
Ja, dus er is al heel veel toegang voor België. En nou ja, waar we het ook over hadden, Amerika, China, Rusland zitten waarschijnlijk ook al in die data.
Ja, dat denk ik wel. Er zijn zeer geavanceerde aanvallen die we ook op dit moment kunnen zien, waarin achterdeuren worden geplaatst in de kernel van Linux bijvoorbeeld. Nou ja, soms worden die opgemerkt, maar ik denk als je ziet wat er wordt opgemerkt, dat er ook een hoop niet opgemerkt wordt.
Dat betekent dus letterlijk dat er een achteringang is waar zij naar binnen kunnen om bij die informatie te kunnen.
Ja, inderdaad. Dan kunnen ze vanaf afstand een systeem overnemen.
Hey, en als we dan toch, for the sake of the argument, naar België gaan. Hè? Dus België heeft kwaad in de zin. En ze willen alle mensen die niet in Nederland geboren zijn het land uit hebben. En wij willen al die mensen, waaronder Evelyn, redden door iets te doen met die data die opgeslagen liggen in de BRP. Het is dan al heel belangrijk wanneer we dit willen. Dus, want ja, je zei al, ze hebben waarschijnlijk al toegang tot die data. Maar goed, laten we zeggen, we weten dat België van plan is om Nederland aan te vallen. En we willen iets met die data. Wat ga jij dan eerst allemaal onderzoeken om te bepalen wat je gaat doen?
Ja, ik denk inderdaad dat we ervan uit kunnen gaan dat België de informatie heeft. Dus dat noem je een assume breach principe. Ze zullen misschien flarden hebben van de informatie. Ze kunnen het op basis van openbare bronnen hebben. Maar wellicht hebben ze al een tijdje ingebroken in onze systemen digitaal. En hebben ze een tijdje mee kunnen kijken.
Dus we gaan ervan uit dat ze misschien al flarden van die gegevens hebben. Dus wij moeten iets met dat BRP. Dus welke dingen moet je dan eerst van die systemen weten, zodat wij daar iets mee kunnen?
Precies.
In plaats van België.
Dus we willen het BRP eigenlijk beveiligen tegen een aanval van België.
Ja.
Ik denk dat het BRP wel redelijk veilig is al. Daar zal goed over nagedacht zijn. In ieder geval de beschikbaarheid zoals die is aangetast tijdens de Tweede Wereldoorlog. Door een gebouw in de brand te zetten. Dat zal nu wat lastiger worden, denk ik. Omdat data gemakkelijker te verspreiden is, te kopiëren is. Dus een aanval op de beschikbaarheid zal lastig zijn. Maar wat we wel zouden kunnen proberen is een aanval op de integriteit.
En wat betekent dat?
Dus je kunt eraan denken om valse informatie te verspreiden. Kijk, als je iets wil verdedigen, dan moet je goed nadenken over wie gaat ons aanvallen en met welk motief en welke mogelijkheden hebben ze daarvoor. Nou, kun je eraan denken dat als België toegang wil krijgen tot het BRP, dat zij bijvoorbeeld een aanval uitvoeren op de softwareontwikkelaars van de BRP's. Maar je zou ook misschien een laptop kunnen stelen waar toevallig een backup op staat van die data. Wat wij dan als verdedigers kunnen doen, is misschien meer laptops verspreiden met valse data.
Mm-hmm.
Bijvoorbeeld.
En je hebt het dan zo in kaart gebracht, hè? Dus je weet nu waar er backups zijn in principe, of dat er veel backups zijn. Je weet dat België kwaad in zin heeft. En je weet dat er data in dat BRP zit, nou ja, die een onveiligheid oplevert voor de mensen die je wilt beschermen. Jij zegt dat de grootste kans waarschijnlijk zit in de integriteit van die data. Dus ervoor zorgen dat die data vervuild worden. Dat betekent dus dat die data niet meer betrouwbaar zijn voor degene die ze eruit halen, toch?
Ja, inderdaad.
Oké. En dit heb je dan in kaart gebracht. Wat is dan je volgende stap?
Nou, dan is het dus even de vraag, hoeveel tijd hebben we en wie gaat er meewerken? Eigenlijk zijn we op dit moment een aanvaller en een verdediger tegelijk. Want we willen het BRP aanvallen, maar we willen het BRP ook verdedigen tegen die andere aanvaller.
Mm-hmm.
En dan vechten we tegen een statelijke actor. Een statelijke actor heeft misschien wel onbeperkt geld, heeft toegang tot systemen en lijntjes die je als rebel misschien niet hebt.
Mm-hmm.
Ze kunnen misbruik maken van zero days, dus kwetsbaarheden die nog niet bekend zijn.
Mm-hmm.
En het is even de vraag of wij dat ook hebben en of we BRP zelf gaan aanvallen. Of dat we misschien wel meewerking hebben van de Nederlandse overheid of van de gemeente. Je zou kunnen denken aan het aanmaken van valse informatie. Een gemeente zou dat kunnen.
Mm-hmm.
Maar er zitten natuurlijk wel integriteitschecks op die data. Het systeem is wel vormgegeven op zo'n manier dat er integriteit gewaarborgd is.
Maar het zou dus wel helpen. Dus als we even de oorlogssituatie zoals die toen was, hoe zeg je dat? Vertalen naar nu. Zouden we kunnen concluderen, we hebben niet de hele overheid aan onze kant, maar misschien wel mensen binnen de overheid. En dan zeg je, dan zouden echt hele goede allies zouden zijn mensen die bij de gemeente werken, die BRP-registraties doen.
Bijvoorbeeld, kijk, stel je voor we hebben 100 jaar of 50 jaar, dan kun je natuurlijk gewoon een nieuwe baby registreren, ik noem maar wat. Als dat 10 jaar is, ja, dan moeten we, misschien, of 5 jaar of misschien maar 1 jaar, dan moeten we ja, toch heel snel zorgen dat we ook backups gaan infecteren of iets dergelijks. Daar moeten we goed over nadenken. En hoe komen we daar? Of kunnen we de backups misschien wel onbereikbaar maken of onbruikbaar maken?
En dus deze tijdspanne, stel dat we een maand hebben.
Ja.
Dat lijkt me een realistische tijdspanne. Misschien een maand, 2.
Een maand is kort om zo'n systeem aan te vallen. Mm-hmm. Dit is natuurlijk een systeem waar heel veel mensen heel lang over nagedacht hebben. Mm-hmm. En aan de andere kant is het ook een systeem wat een hoop legacy met zich meebrengt. Dus er zal wel wat te winden zijn. En als
wat betekent een hoop legacy met zich meebrengt?
Veroudering van het systeem.
Ah, ja.
Dus ook software moet je onderhouden. En als je dat niet onderhoudt, dan kunnen er kwetsbaarheden ontstaan of gevonden worden waar je misbruik van kan maken. Als we een maand hebben en we hebben een aantal goede hackers, ja, dan vinden we misschien wel een route naar de source van die data. Mm-hmm. En dan zou je daar wat mee kunnen.
Mm-hmm.
Dan zou je de integriteit of misschien zelfs de beschikbaarheid van die informatie kunnen aantasten.
Mm-hmm.
Maar zoals we al zeiden, de beschikbaarheid, er zijn backups. En we moeten ervan uitgaan dat we niet alle backups offline kunnen halen.
Maar stel je hebt bijvoorbeeld een jaar om dit voor te bereiden. Dan kan je wat zorgvuldiger te werk gaan. Wat zou je dan kunnen doen?
Dan zou ik in eerste instantie de aanval nog steeds op dezelfde manier uitvoeren. Maar dan heb je wel wat langer de tijd om even rond te kijken in de systemen. En mogelijk kun je ook de integriteit van de backups dan aantasten.
Hmm.
Want er worden natuurlijk misschien wel dagelijks of wekelijks of maandelijks backups gemaakt.
Mm-hmm.
Als je de integriteit weet aan te tasten en je kunt de validaties daarvan omzeilen. Ik zou je ook de integriteit van de backups kunnen aantasten.
Hmm.
En dan ben je een heel eind.